Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Should be a good show for today. Whoa, why is my mic so hot? Oh, something bad happened there. Jeez, sorry everybody. What the hell? I don't even know how it got like that. Alright. How's this? Is that alright? Jeez, sorry about your eardrums. Hope I didn't blow any inwards too hard. All right, well, don't sue me. It's an accident. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show, where I complain about how much I hate the government and interview people. Today on the show, Gareth Porter will have his basically his full wrap-up on the Iranian PMD, the possible military dimensions, and the IAEA's final report about it all. You'll like it. I bet. Also, Daniel Larrison is here, holding down the Peacenik Foreign Policy for the American Conservative magazine. He's no rhino liberal centrist rightist, like, say, the warmonger John McCain. Oh, no. He's a conservative, and that's why he's anti-war. Get it? Maybe. We'll have Daniel Larrison on to talk about the war in Yemen, which is such an evil. It's amazing and incredible and unbelievable and unforgivable that the war in Yemen is not even really a discussion in this country whatsoever right now. When America, of course, owns it 100%. And you could say, oh, well, the Americans are just kissing the Saudis' ass and doing what they want on this one. But whatever. They can't do it without us, so simple as that. It's Obama's war. He's been bombing Al-Qaeda for years over there, making more and more of them. Now he's outright flying as their air force against the Houthis. It's just incredible. It's unbelievable. But it's the truth. And Daniel Larrison's going to be on to explain about that. We're just shipping more and more bombs over there. For the Saudis to drop on the enemies of Osama. And then Dan Sanchez is going to be on to talk about Star Wars. Because, hey, Star Wars! I had a dream last night that J.J. Abrams wouldn't let me see the movie. I can't remember what it was that I supposedly did that made him so mad at me. And then my attitude was like, fine, I don't care then. That's how you're going to be. But then I think I was privately complaining. Like, man, that's really not fair. I wanted to see it. Well, I'm kind of a kook. You knew that when you tuned in. That's how my brain is, man. It's a messed up place. But I love Star Wars, man. I'm going to go see Star Wars. The wife and I got tickets to the 7:30 show. 30 because I guess there's going to be half hour worth of commercials before it starts. But yep, going to be great. And then I'll tell you all about it on the show tomorrow. No, I won't. But I also, I bought tickets for tomorrow night, too. When I bought them for Thursday, I said, I'm going to want to go on Friday too, aren't I? Yes, of course. So go ahead and get those tickets bought. Get that out of the way. Maybe next week at some point, I'm going to try to find some time to go see it on the IMAX 3D. I think I explained to you guys yesterday. The wife, she can't do IMAX 3D. It'll explode her brain. But I can. So that'll be coming up soon enough. Anyway. I don't know. You know what? I'll tell you what. Instead of me going on and on about Star Wars, I'll tell you this. If you search for my name, Scott Horton, and Star Wars, you can, one, read an article that I wrote about it 10 years ago. Jesus, can you believe that was 10 years ago? 10.5. Man. And then also, you can find, in fact, that article links to the audio of a thing I did back in 2005, right before Revenge of the Sith came out, where I was explaining the politics and all the wars, the health of the state type stuff, and all the historical allusions and everything in the prequels, basically. And I talked a little bit about the original movies, too, but since George Lucas couldn't tell his own story right, nobody understood what the hell it was, I kind of went through it to try to explain it. And I don't know how good it was, because it was 10 years ago, so maybe I would change it some if I heard it now, but anyway. So, if you want to hear me talk about Star Wars, just check out scotthorton.org. If you go to the All Interviews page, look for May 2005, it's there. Scott discusses Star Wars. And I interview Mark Thornton from the Mises Institute about it, too. Today on the show, like I say, Dan Sanchez is going to be talking about. All right, so now I don't have much time before all the interviews start, so let me go over a couple of things for you real quick. You just heard at the top of the hour news there. Do I have the best top of the hour radio news, the LRN? Do they have the best top of the hour radio news in the history of top of the hour radio news or what? Man, the years I suffered through, you know, Fox or worse. It's great having the FPP radio news. Okay, so there's that. And you heard there he was discussing the murder of Freddie Gray and the hung jury, which means, and I'm pretty sure the prosecutor will be refiling the charges. I don't know if they've already announced that or not, but they probably will. The strategy was that this was going to be the easiest guy to convict, and then they were going to flip him and use him to testify against the others in exchange for leniency or something like that. Well, it didn't work out too well. And it's such a tragedy to me. It's double extra compounded tragedy from the murder of the young man that when jurors, that is, civilians, regular humans, have the chance to convict a cop of a crime, which is one in a million, that a prosecutor would ever bring charges against a cop for killing somebody. That virtually never happens. And yet when it does, they're acquitted. The same thing with the lady cop who went complete psycho. I mean, if you watch the footage of it, it's just absolutely insane. The guy's laying on the ground, his arms out in front of him. He took off running. I don't know why, but he was only wanted for an expired tax stamp on his windshield. I swear to God. Expired inspection sticker. He's laying on the ground with his hands out in front of him. She's screaming at him in the most just lunatic way. It's incredible. She makes the mother on Malcolm in the Middle look like she's in a coma. And then she just shoots him. She just puts two bullets in his back for no reason. And he asks, he's like, why did you just shoot me? I can't believe you did it. You killed me just now. What? And the jury says, oh, no, whatever. She can kill whoever she wants. She's a cop. We love it. I know everybody always says this, but I'm going to say it right now. My version's better. There ought to be a law that says no government employees or their kin should be allowed to serve on juries in the United States of America. Enough of this we the people crap. The government are the enemies of all of the rest of us. There's us and then there's them. They are the criminal conspiracy. And in all of these cases, I'll bet you dimes to dollars. Dollars to dimes, I guess, is the way you're supposed to say that. That it's some cop's spouse up there goes, nuh-uh. Some retired sheriff. Cops can do whatever they want, and you can lay down and die. That's the law.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.
All right, y'all. It's me and my show and all that. Yeah, Fred a great thing. Okay, I covered that. Interest rates. They raised the federal funds rate a quarter point, right? I only was barely paying attention. Oh, man, I forgot to turn off the heater. Hope that's not too loud for you guys. Let's see. Yeah, that's background noise. Hang on a second, man. Let me get some audio to play here and fix that for you. Oh, man, I hit the damn button. Go, you stupid thing. Live radio, I'll tell you what. Cannot get the soundbite player to play a soundbite. Hey, why are you a soundbite player if you don't play soundbites? Huh? Explain that to me. Huh. Alright. Won't play them at all, huh? Okay, I'll use something else. How about some AC/DC? You gonna play some AC/DC for me? What is wrong with this freaking computer, man? You're killing me here. Killing me. Oh, you know what it is? No, it couldn't be. The Flash player, really? It's the only thing that ever screws up my audio tech this bad. It's a Flash player crashed on some window somewhere. Great. Alright. Why do I still have Flash player at all? I don't know. You know I don't know. You know I have no excuse. You know, I don't know if I can even fix it if I reboot all of this crap. Alright, well, at least there's a terrible background white noise in the background of the show. So that it sounds terrible for everyone. You know, at least I got that going for me. Yeah. Turn off Skype, too. That has audio codec craps in it. Alright, now let's see what happens. If I reopen the damn thing and try to play a damn thing. There you go. Ian's gonna get mad at me if I just play music for the whole segment. Alright, well, it's my stupid, freaking, horribly produced show. Hey, the spotlight today on antiwar.com is really good about nukes by Joe Cirincione from the Plowshares thing. And I guess I'll admit that I'm not always his biggest fan. Ultimately minor reasons. But this article's really great, man. And it's about, man, really? We're going to spend trillions of dollars redoing the whole damn nuclear triad? Like, we don't have enough, lethal enough hydrogen bombs. The guy that invented the A-bomb called the H-bomb a weapon of genocide. It was way past the line for the guy that invented the fission bomb. Said fusion? Nope, that's too hot. They're made for killing cities full of millions of people. That's what they're for, the H-bombs, and we should be getting rid of them entirely. And isn't it fun for you, like it is for me, to imagine an America where somehow anyone who is in business with the government and they try to lobby the government, they immediately explode and die and cease to exist. And so that just can't happen at all. And then, so there's just no incentive to keep this up. No military industrial complex whatsoever. And the government is run by people who have thought for a moment about the interests of the 300 million civilians that live in this land between Canada and Mexico. Isn't it obvious that their policy would be to abolish as many as they possibly can, and that they would focus all of their diplomacy on the planet on getting the rest of the nuclear weapons states to also abandon their nuclear weapons? You know, Donald Rumsfeld, well, no, I guess it was Robert Gates, but still, George W. Bush's father's man and a Republican, the Secretary of Defense for, you know, Bush's second one and Obama's first one, he commissioned a study. This isn't in the Cerincione piece for some reason, but he commissioned a study in the late aughts there where, and it was from the Office of the Secretary of Defense that published it. It was, I guess, mostly Air Force guys. And they said we could be fine. America's military could protect our national interests. We could deter attack from any power on Earth with 14 nuclear weapons. Sorry for pronouncing it like that. I just didn't want anyone to think I said 40. 14. That's it. 1-4. That's enough to threaten Russia, China, all of Europe, Israel, Pakistan, and India. You better not nuke us, because we will kill you back. That's it. That's all we need for a deterrent. Now, if you want to hold all of humanity hostage in order to try to force your benevolent global hegemony, then maybe you do need 7,000. Maybe you do need a triad and all this crap. But in the real world, communism is dead. The Soviet Union's been gone for 25 years. China has gone from communism to fascism 40 years ago. Our Cold War with China ended 40 years ago. Nixon went and shook hands with Mao Zedong 40 years ago. The rest of the nuclear weapons states, including India and Pakistan, at each other's throats, probably the most likely nuclear confrontation on the planet right now, are all allies of ours. The Israelis, all the Europeans, and the Russians and the Chinese can be dealt with unless we, you know, stick with full spectrum dominance, first strike capability over them. But we just don't need this. And it's, I understand it's the lowest priority of the American people, because who cares about nukes? Because nobody ever talks about nukes. Nobody ever uses them on each other. It's been since America nuked Japan that somebody, you know, I mean, obviously our governments have nuked their own employees making them. There's a giant special in McClatchy newspapers this week about that, by the way. I'm going to see if I can get the guy on tomorrow about it. But it is just absolutely insane that the United States, that the people of this country, that the people of the planet tolerate the status quo with the nuclear arsenals. They absolutely must be dismantled immediately.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime future freedom author Scott McPherson, Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here, the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here.
Ah, what a mess.
I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to get a hold of Garrett there for a second. I was just going to talk about how much, screw you, I like the Ewoks. I don't care. For a whole segment. I watched the despecialized version of Return of the Jedi last night. It was great. And, you know, I hadn't seen Return of the Jedi in so long that it was really great, man. It was almost sort of kind of watching it new again in a way, kind of a little bit. It was good. You can get it on the Pirate Bay, the despecialized version. Anyway. Yes, our first guest up today is, of course, the great Gareth Porter. And I say, of course, because he's got a write-up, a full write-up now, not just on Parchin, but on the entire IAEA final report on Iran's possible military dimensions. Welcome back to the show, Gareth. How are you doing?
Hi, Scott. Thanks again for having me on. I'm fine.
Good, good. Very happy to have you here. Everybody, you know Gareth. He wrote the book on the Iranian nuclear scare, as it's called in the subtitle. It's Manufactured Crisis. Of course, Manufactured Crisis. Writes for Middle East Eye and for Truth Out. And this one is at Low Blog and Mozilla updated without asking me. And so now the tab is lost because it destroyed my tab kit. Here it goes. Lowblog.com. The IAEA's final assessment. And so we talked already about, you know, kind of the ridiculous way they tried to defend their previous accusations while climbing down from them at the same time in regards to the pretended explosion chamber at Parchin. But now you're kind of taking a more holistic approach to the entire PMD report here. So I guess what's first on the list that you'd have people know, Gareth?
Well, in this piece, Scott, what I tried to do was two different things at the same time or together in the same piece. First of all, trying to give some historical context to this final assessment by the IAEA, telling the story very briefly again of how the IAEA really became what I call the prosecutor for the United States and the coalition the U.S. has been leading, the prosecutor against Iran. And in the sense that, of course, what a prosecutor does is try to get a guilty verdict. Or if you can't get a guilty verdict, you use the news media, you put out stories that make it look like the defendant is guilty. And that means that you simply use all the tricks available to you to skew opinion in the direction of a suspicion that the, target of your case is guilty. And that's exactly what the IAEA has done since 2008 in particular. I mean, there were some slight indications of that even before that, back in 2003, 2004, up to 2000 through 2007. But really, you know, the story of the IAEA as prosecutor begins in earnest in 2008. And I've written about that before, and I'm sure we've talked about it on your show as well. But, you know, what they've done is to essentially keep Iran in the dock of world opinion, under suspicion and under accusation of having, dabbled in nuclear weapons development, research and development, while the United States, was carrying out policy of maximizing pressure, and this is both under George W. Bush and Obama administrations, maximizing the pressure on Iran for a variety of reasons. And you know, to go to the Obama administration, part of this clearly the purpose was to try to force Iran to essentially concede its entire program of uranium enrichment, to give it up, which was what the Obama administration's aim was in the first 4 years, the first administration. And so the IAEA really has fulfilled that mission by, in its, all of its reports, continuing to repeat the same sort of mantra. And in the final assessment, and here's the second part of my story, my article, what I do is break down, the ways in which the IAEA, the tactics, that the IAEA has used in order to maintain the pose that
Am I losing you here? Wait. I'm sorry. Gareth, we had a little glitch there. Pose that what?
Okay, can you hear it now?
And it's a little breaky uppy, but try again.
Okay. Well, what they were doing is using a series of tactics to keep the idea that Iran is suspect of having carried out research and development of nuclear weapons, without really explicitly making the charge in a direct sense. And I think this is very important to understand that distinction. Mm-hmm. And they do it over and over again. And I point out that, one of the key tactics is to use the language of relevance or relevant to, instead of saying that Iran had, technology or an organization, or research that was in fact about nuclear weapons. What they say, they use the language, that in one way or another, says that Iran was doing something that was relevant to, relevant to development of nuclear weapons. And that is a very interesting and obvious clue, as to the modus operandi of the IAEA, just how, deceptive, and fundamentally dishonest their entire approach has been.
Yeah, in other words, they're caught out just by their Fox News type speech, where just series of implications that, well, look, they have this that could be used for this, and they have this that could be used for that. But so am I reading you right here then, that you're saying that even in the final report, not only do they not show an Iranian nuclear program, but they don't even show an Iranian, I mean, nuclear weapons program, pardon me, but they don't even show an Iranian nuclear weapons research program. Never mind making a bomb, but even a program to really figure out how to, whether or not they could, and this kind of thing. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. They do not at any point in this final assessment say that we have identified this evidence that Iran carried out this this research or development experiment or set of experiments that were for nuclear weapons. Instead, they resort to this very deceptive language that that essentially is inconclusive, but is written in such a way as to leave the impression that yes, that it looks like Iran's behavior or institutions were highly suspect.
I'm sorry, before the break here, Gareth, I wanted to work in a correction here that's entirely my own error. I got an email from Gordon Prather, who listened to our interview and said, no, man, I never said that they could test an implosion system with lead. This is tangential to our discussion about Parchin, whether they could use substitute metals in the IAEA report. They talk about tungsten, as you've already ridiculed in your other piece. But I had thought that Gordon Prather had told me that it was possible to use lead for those kind of experiments, which was a red herring because it wasn't in the report anyway. And then Gordon corrected me that was entirely not right, that I must have been confused and some other reference to lead in our discussions and conflated it, something like that. So sorry to everyone who heard that, and for the red herring there is entirely my own screw up. But anyway, we'll be right back with the great Gareth Porter to talk more about this final IAEA report on the possible military dimensions in just a minute. Check him out at lowblog.com.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the great libertarian social network. They've got all the social media bells and whistles. Plus, you get your own publishing site, and there are classes, shows, books, and resources of all kinds.
and I host two shows on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire with Liberty.me's Chief Liberty Officer Jeffrey Tucker every other Tuesday, and The Future of Freedom with FFF founder and president Jacob Hornberger every Thursday night, both at 8 Eastern. When you sign up, add me as a friend on there. ScottHorton.Liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at Darren'sCoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darren'sCoffee.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. As always, I'm interviewing the great Gareth Porter about a thing he wrote. It could be called the Scott Interviews Gareth Porter Show, really. They claimed a thing, and so he wrote about it. So I'm interviewing him. It's finally the final report of the International Atomic Energy Agency on the accusations known as the possible military dimensions of Iran's nuclear program. And, Gareth, you're really right. I wish I could figure out a way to argue with you a bit or something, but I read the IAEA report, and it is all a bunch of, geez, well, they have a thing that is consistent with a possible use of this, that, the other thing, and they don't even really try much harder than that to say that, you know, this shows they really were pursuing nuclear weapons. And so my question for you really is, you know, in your book where you go through and explain all the dual use technology in the possible military dimensions from the, you know, so-called smoking laptop or laptop of death or whatever, the fake laptop, and then plus the other accusations, are these all the same ones that you've already shown that, no, dummy, the ring magnets are sitting on a counter at the university just like they said they were, and et cetera like that?
No. They have, over the last few years, I mean, since 2008, essentially there's this other series of intelligence documents and reports, all of which came from the Israelis. This, of course, directly reported by former Director General of the IAEA, Mohammed El-Baradei, in his memoirs, 2011, that the Israelis turned over a whole collection of these documents and intelligence reports. And although he revealed this in his memoirs that it was from the Israelis, that they turned them over directly, the IAEA has never allowed the reading public to know, you know, who it was who turned these documents over. And of course, this is really one of the great unreported, untold scandals of the IAEA.
Let me just make sure I understand. You're saying there's, if I understand right, there's kind of three big different batches of fake accusations here. One is the intercepted teletypes. One is the smoking laptop of fraud. And then the third is the report that the Israelis handed over. Is that
Absolutely.
Right? And we're talking about the third batch now is what's really under investigation. The first two closed.
Scott, you're one of the very few people in the world who would be able to absolutely nail the complexity of the evidence that we're talking about here. Yes, it's the third group of documents which were turned over by Israel from 2008 and 2008-2009, and some then came a little bit later. That's really what's reflected in a 2011 IAEA report, which was the one that the United States and its allies badly wanted to be have attached to an IAEA report as an annex. And Mohammed El-Baradei refused to do it because he said, look, these materials, these documents have never been authenticated. We can't vouch for them. So we can't put out a report that is based entirely on this unauthenticated set of documents. But of course, Amano came in on, he was a guy who the Americans chose to support as the successor to El-Baradei precisely because he had been enthusiastically on board in 2008 when the U.S. was putting pressure on El-Baradei, to embrace these documents, and he didn't want to do it. So they, you know, supported him to become the director general. And it was on the assumption, on the understanding, I should say, that he would, in fact, publish this compendium of intelligence reports, essentially blessing them, giving the IAEA's blessing that they're credible, when the United States wanted him to publish them, when it would do the most good politically and diplomatically for them, which was, in fact, late 2011, when the United States was working on the essentially putting together the international coalition to support the crippling sanctions against Iran that we saw put in place in 2012.
All right. So now when this report came out, though, all the headlines said, oh, man, see, yeah, and especially all the neocons. Oh, the CIA was wrong when they said that their nuclear weapons program ceased in 2003. It continued all the way through 2009. What specifically are they basing that year number on? Do you know? Is that,
yes,
what's in there?
Yeah, it is very explicit that what they're referring to in the report is the famous neutron initiator document, which I've written about, we've talked about on your show years ago, 2009, was it? I believe it was 2009, 2010. And of course, that document was a fake. And even U.S. intelligence and European intelligence agencies recognized that it wasn't authentic, and wouldn't really give it their blessing. And in that document, it's suggested that there's a 4-year plan to carry out research on neutron, using neutrons for various purposes, and it's implied very strongly that one of them is for nuclear weapons. It's not stated explicitly, but that is clearly the implication that is.
Oh, Gareth, you cut out on me. I lost you after implication.
Intended to be left by that document. The implication was left of that this was a 4-year program for relating to nuclear weapons. And that's where they get the 2000, because this was supposedly a 2006 document. The judgment has been then rendered that their indications, as they would put it, that the Iranians had continued activities as late as 2009. Mm-hmm. That's what it's all about.
Right. And then they refer, surprisingly, I thought, in the piece to the graph, and you mentioned this in your piece again at lowblog.com about this graph that they had previously leaked to George John at the AP, that I had mistakenly believed that nuclear physicist Yosef Butt had successfully laughed off the face of the earth back when it came out. With his article in Reuters saying that, listen, whoever forged this obviously doesn't know the first damn thing about fission. So get the hell out of here.
Yes, you're absolutely right. It was laughed off the earth. In effect, you know, it was clear that this graph was done by somebody who didn't know anything about the technology or the numbers or the methodology to do such a graph. It was a high school student or an undergraduate or something like that. You know, the IAEA should have shamefacedly admitted it in a report, but of course they don't do that. They are protected by the most powerful nation on earth, and therefore they just continue to ignore it. And I think I mentioned in my article that I actually questioned, well, I didn't say it was me, but Amano was appearing at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C., and I asked him, what about this graph? Is this the one that the IAEA was referring to in its report in 2011? He refused to answer the question. And, of course, they ignored this entire issue in the final assessment because it's too embarrassing. Instead, they, you know, again, used weasel wording to avoid the truth about this whole set of issues.
It's amazing. All right. So now What's left? We got the bridge wires, obviously parching. Marivan, we've discussed before that if there's anything to it, then how come the IAEA won't show up to go and inspect it? You learn anything new about the Marivan accusations in here? Or what else am I missing, Gareth?
No, absolutely not. I mean, you know, they make the interesting observation that we have assessed that, the alleged experiments with high explosives that they suggested were related to nuclear weapons development took place in a site called Marivan, not a region called Marivan. Now, what the significance of that is anybody's guess, because they don't give any further explanation. But they do not respond at all.
Well, it sounds like what they're saying is, you know, sort of like there's a street named Austin Avenue in the center of Georgetown, Texas, and they're saying, well, you know, Marivan, the nuclear site, could be anywhere, not necessarily anywhere near the actual place. Is that right?
Well, I mean, you could derive that from what they said, but there's no explanation, so it's anybody's guess what they mean by that. I think you're right I think what they're doing is covering up the fact that they were never really told where this was. And so, you know, they couldn't even have visited it had they wanted to. But the bottom line here, Scott, is that it's very clear to me that the IAEA has known for quite a while now that they were had. You know, there have been enough revelations by Robert Kelly, by other former IAEA officials, Tariq Rauf. Things that I've written have you know, been part of the mix that show that the IAEA just, you know, got it wrong, and that they were given information that was false. And of course, the IAEA doesn't want to admit it, and they don't have to politically because they have this protection. So that's really what's going on in the case of Marivan, as in the case of all these other issues. But I do want to, in the very little time I'm sure we have remaining, I do want to mention the one very interesting case where the IAEA really makes a major back down. I mentioned in another article about where they do, and if a very damaging point, but
I'm sorry. No. Gareth, you cut out on us a little bit there. We lost you right at Parchin.
I'm sorry. Okay. Well, I mentioned in another article that they made a back down on Parchin, but specifically on the so-called green salt papers, which part of the original laptop documents.
Right.
They admit for the first time that these papers were really, there was something wrong with them. They say they were of very low quality and not up to what the Iranians had available to them in their declared nuclear program. This is an astonishing admission by the IAEA. And to me, of course, it really signifies that they're aware that this set of documents on the bench scale process for what they call making green salt, but essentially preparing the gas form of uranium for enrichment. They were falsified, and they aren't going to say it, but that's the clear implication of this.
Wow, that's great that they can see that in there. You know, I'm pretty sure, I'd hate to go misquoting the guy again, but I'm pretty damn sure that this is exactly what Gordon Prather said when the so-called smoking laptop was first revealed, that it made no sense for these bench-level experiments in converting the yellow cake to tetrafluoride green salt, because you can't do anything with that anyway. It's got to be hexafluoride gas. And they already had a facility for doing that at Isfahan.
Well, exactly.
So why in the world would they even have this in the first place?
I'm sure that Gordon did say exactly that. And, you know, I've written that as well in my book. And that's what the Iranians were explicitly arguing at the time when the issue was brought to them, when they were shown these documents. They said, look, this doesn't make any sense at all. Plus, they pointed out that the documents were seriously flawed. And even Hainunen, Ali Hainunen, the head of the Safeguards Department, had to admit that they were right. that there were serious flaws in the documents.
Hey, give them credit for even bringing it up again in this thing. You'd think they might have just forgot about that.
Well, it's true.
One of the more clownish of their errors, but still.
And who knows why they chose to do that? I mean, that's sort of in the area where I'm not able to really provide any guidance or any clarification as to what their motive was in doing that.
Yeah. Well, I better let you go. You'll probably want to watch Obama threatening the world right now live on TV. And I got to get Daniel Larrison on the show to talk about America and Saudi murdering Yemenis all day. So thank you very much for coming back on the show, Gareth. You're the best, man.
Thanks, Scott.
All right, y'all. That is the heroic Gareth Porter this time. He is back at Jim Loeb's blog, loeblog.com, the IAEA's final assessment. It'll be the spotlight tomorrow on antiwar.com. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support The Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Okay, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Again, happy Star Wars Day to everybody. It's the only kind of wars I like. Although they are the health of the state, as Daniel Sanchez will be discussing with us here in just a little while. But first, it's our friend Daniel Larrison from the American Conservative Magazine to talk about the bad kind of wars, the real ones, America's, most specifically. Welcome back. How are you doing, Daniel?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Scott, for having me back.
Very happy to have you here. And everybody, you should know, if you don't, that Daniel Larrison is daily holding down peaceful foreign policy at the American Conservative Magazine. That's the AmericanConservative.com, and very, very valuable stuff there virtually constantly, always. So keep your eyeballs peeled for that. Yeah, no doubt about it. Okay, so there's a lot to talk about, and you've got a lot of great commentary on these Republican candidates running for president and all the various insane things that they say and claim and plan. First we got to talk about Obama's war in Yemen. And hard to believe this thing started in March. It's still going on. And of course, as we've discussed previously on the show, the Saudi effort is virtually entirely dependent on the United States of America to aid and abet them. And as you write here, arm them. But I guess my first real question for you would be, if I could figure out a way to state it, would be, is this anything but a stalemate? Does it look to you like either side could possibly win a victory here, especially when we hear that the, you know, pseudo ceasefire and move for talks has broken down? Or what is going to happen here? Just years of this still, or what?
It depends, I think, pretty heavily on how many losses the Saudis or their allies are willing to take. They have recently just suffered several dozen more casualties, although a lot of these are mercenaries that they hire and bring in from private contractors from out of the area. In fact, the UAE has been using Colombian ex-military folks to do a lot of their fighting in Yemen now, because they don't want to lose their own people, since that would become unpopular. The coalition hasn't been making much progress since it advanced a few months ago in the south, and they seem to be stuck around Taiz, which is one of the central cities of Yemen, south of the capital. And at the moment, it does seem to be a stalemate. That's one of the reasons why the UN envoy was able to get them to the table, at least, although, as you say, the truce for the peace talks has already started breaking down. I think the coalition will keep pressing on for as long as is tolerable for them domestically at home. And unfortunately, that means for the people of Yemen that they're going to continue to be blockaded, they're going to continue to be bombed for the foreseeable future. And our support doesn't seem to be relenting at any point. As you may have already mentioned to your audience, the U.S. just sold or just approved the sale of another $1.3 billion in weapons, precision-guided munitions and things like that, to the Saudis so that they can continue to drop them on Yemen.
Well, okay, so maybe we should go back to my first premise here that the Saudi war is entirely dependent on America's help here. Do you think that that's really right? Or if Obama decided to get tough with them and say enough of this, would they just tell him to buzz off and keep going anyway, or what?
It is heavily dependent on our support, both in terms of refueling their planes and in providing them with weapons to replace the weapons that they're expending. So it's conceivable that they could continue without U.S. support for a while, but they wouldn't be able to keep it going indefinitely. But what U.S. support does is relieve the pressure on them and allow them to extend their campaign much longer than they would otherwise be able to do it. So we're directly making a peace settlement more difficult to reach because of this continued support.
All right, now, is there any U.S. interest, and I don't mean, interest of you and me and the American people, but is there any interest that the U.S. government even really has in supporting this war other than in just kissing the ass of the Saudis here?
At this point, I can't see what it would be. It started off nominally as an effort to restore the Yemeni government, the government of President Hadi. But Hadi is now so deeply unpopular and has so little support in the country because of his support for the bombing campaign and the blockade that there's no way he or probably anyone else associated with his government would be able to come back into power without some sort of power-sharing agreement with the Houthis and other parts of the forces opposing him. So at this point, the U.S. is fighting to restore a government that can't be restored, or we're helping them to fight to restore a government that can't be restored. And in the meantime, the one security interest that we may have in that place, preventing the growth of jihadist groups, is being completely ignored and, in fact, being undermined because al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and the local ISIS affiliate are making significant gains, and both territorially and in terms of their propaganda.
Yeah.
As a result of the security vacuum that the war has created.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, Obama's been bombing al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula with drones and regular airstrikes, I guess, too, for years now, supported Saleh, gave him all this money and all these weapons that he used to fight the Houthis and accidentally make them more and more powerful each time he lost to them, and help, to precipitate all of this. But at least, on the surface, America was fighting against al-Qaeda. But now, as you say, he's completely undermined that by fighting against al-Qaeda's worst enemies, the Houthis. And I have read, at least here and there, of a couple of drone strikes against al-Qaeda targets during this, which just makes it where we're fighting on both sides. But it seems like, we're much more backing al-Qaeda than fighting them in Yemen at this point. And for light and transient causes, right? Like, isn't that what, out of the Declaration of Independence, there's no other reason here? I mean, maybe they're paranoid about losing control over the gates of the Red Sea there or something? I mean, there's got to be some other bogus reason that they're glomming onto here. It's just because that's what the new Saudi king's son wants to do for, or whatever?
It's what the new Saudi leaders want to do. It's what a lot of the Gulf states want to do, evidently. And that's driven by their paranoia about Iran. Now, as we've talked about before, Iran's role in this is minimal, if it exists at all. So what we're really doing is indulging the Saudis and their allies in an irrational fear about Iranian influence that isn't even really there. And for that dubious cause, inflicting a lot of suffering on tens of millions of people. I just saw a statistic that came, I think, from the UN that the percentage of people in Yemen that require humanitarian aid is now a bit higher than it used to be. It's 82%. And the total number of people in need of humanitarian aid is over 20 million, which is actually significantly higher than the number of people in Syria that need aid. And all of that has come about just in the last year.
Unreal. And then, you know, we could do an entire documentary on the silence of the Western media about this, too. It's just unbelievable. It's not even noteworthy whatsoever to them. I mean, I guess I don't watch the nightly news on NBC or whatever, but I watch the cable news, and there's no mention of it ever.
No, it is by and large neglected in the U.S. and in Western media more generally. The BBC has done some good work in covering it. The New York Times wrote a pretty decent editorial about it the other day, but it's very hit and miss. It's very sporadic. And I think one of the reasons for that is that I don't think there's a lot of attention being paid to it because it was so preoccupied with ISIS, with the other war going on in Iraq and Syria,
yeah,
that ends up drowning everything else out.
Yeah. Could make for a great political argument, though, for Trump or Rand or anybody who wants, even Cruz, to try to make a little sense up there. Hey, these guys got us flying as Al-Qaeda's Air Force right now. What's up with that, guys? Let's crack some jokes and get some, you know, a little bit of reality into that discussion. Anyway, hang tight, y'all. We'll be right back with the great Daniel Larrison from theamericanconservative.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment. MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to mpvengineering.com.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Daniel Larrison from the American Conservative Magazine about the disaster in Yemen. And, boy, it just sounds unbelievable, doesn't everybody, to hear the man say. Here we're talking about a story that no one else even talks about, and I hardly ever cover it. What, once every 2 weeks on the show or something? There's hardly anybody to interview about it, except Daniel. And then you hear him say things like 82% of the population of this country is in need of food and or medical aid immediately. 82%. That's the USA doing that to them. And, you know, it reminds me of the other most uncovered massacre of the Obama years, and that is the starvation of the Somalis by Barack Obama as well. I mean, it was obviously a drought in the Horn of Africa in 2011 and 12, but it hit the Somalis the hardest because America had turned their society completely upside down. It was really more W. Bush's fault than Obama's, but still, it was Obama's too. And according to FuseNet, which is the famine early warning system, part of the UN, paid for by the U.S. and the U.K., 600,000 people starved to death in Somalia in that famine. And, of course, most of them were children under 5 years old. And then Donald Trump says, we're going to commission a study to figure out why they hate us. For now, our working theory is it's because they're Muslim. Anyway.
The situation in Yemen is many times more severe than the one you just described in Somalia. The humanitarian crisis there has been ranked as a level 3, class 3 emergency, which is the highest level that the UN classifies humanitarian disasters as. And roughly half of the 20 million that I mentioned are exposed to the worst kind of malnutrition and starvation. They're the ones that are on the real brink of famine. They haven't officially declared it a famine yet, but it's right on the edge.
Yeah, absolutely amazing. And then back to, you know, the coverage of it, I guess the real point is there's no Yemen lobby of any description. It's the poorest country in the region. They got nothing to barter, withhold. I guess maybe they've got some coffee businessmen that they used to trade with. Maybe those guys could get together, a single lobbyist, to, you know, try to do something. There's no one sticking up for these people in this country because no one has a vested interest in doing so.
Well, and then one of the problems is that the official government of Yemen is one of the belligerents that's doing this to their own country. So they're the one government that might theoretically have an interest in drawing attention to the crisis is actually has incentive to bury the information or to keep people from paying attention to it or to spin it in a way that makes them look better.
Yeah. So can you explain a little bit about how it came about that they were going to have some talks? How close did they come to really having a ceasefire here? Is that just smoke, put together by foreigners or their real moves toward peace, maybe?
Well, there were more significant moves towards having a truce this time. There was even possibility of a prisoner exchange. I think the prisoner exchange may even have gone forward, although there are still lots of violations of the ceasefire happening on both sides. So this is probably the closest to a real truce that they've had all this year. Each time they had a ceasefire for humanitarian reasons before that, it's broken down and has only lasted maybe a couple of days. This one was supposed to last all of this week while they were negotiating in Switzerland. But as you have already mentioned, it hasn't made it very far into the week.
Yeah. I wanted to mention here too, everybody, when you go and look at Daniel Larrison, theamericanconservative.com/Larrison, you'll find a link there to our friend Kelly Vlahos from the American Conservative and formerly from antiwar.com. And she's got a great news piece at foxnews.com. Critics try but fail to kill $1 billion weapons deal for Saudi Arabia. That's what America is up to right in the midst of all of this. And it's a very well done story that I hope you guys will look at that too. But so now to the politics. It seems like maybe somebody, obviously not Rubio, but maybe Rand, Cruz, or even Trump could make hay of this and point out the absurdity of it and get a little bit of political mileage out of it somehow, something?
It's certainly possible. I think that it would be sort of the perfect issue for someone like Rand Paul to use against both Obama and Rubio, because Rubio is one of the very few to have come out publicly and endorse what the U.S. is doing in supporting the Saudi war. And so it makes sense for him to draw attention to that and then to go after it, but that hasn't seemed to be one of the things he wants to talk about.
Yeah.
I imagine, I mean, Trump could try to make use of it, but I'm not sure that he's really paying attention to those things.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think he could know enough about it. Maybe Cruz could if he wanted to spin it that way. But, it would have to be Rand. Well, what did you think of Rand's performance in the debate the other night?
I thought he did pretty well. I thought he made a number of the right points about the destructive effects of regime change, the destabilizing effects of regime change, how jihadists reap the benefits of those sorts of wars. So as far as it goes, I think he did fine.
Oh, well, that was nice. How about further than it goes?
Well, I mean, I think he could broaden his critique of both Obama's policies and of prevailing Republican views much more than he does. I know you and I, we've talked about this before elsewhere, too. Mm-hmm. But so, for instance, during the debate, there was a lot of raving about the threat from Iran and the Iranian Empire. Chris Christie was talking about, and one of the things that I would have loved to hear from Rand Paul was a dose of skepticism or reality being injected into debate about how Iran's influence isn't actually growing right now. It's being beaten back and it's receding in a lot of places. So that would be a useful sort of threat-deflating move that he could do that I think would get people's attention, or at least would improve the quality of the debate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one of Ron Paul's greatest lines was, wait a minute, we borrow $20 billion from the dictatorship in China so that we can support the dictatorship in Pakistan while we're invading Iraq in the name of creating a democracy. Make sure I got all this straight. And everybody, they don't know how to defend that because he's completely right. You got huge applause. And it seems like Rand could do that too, is just point out all the absurdities and the contradictions of all of this. You guys cry about Iran all day, but, you know, ever since 2003, especially the Republican Party has been at war for Iran in Iraq, and we still are, and you guys support that. So what are you talking about, you know? He could call him out on all of these contradictions. And that was the greatest thing about his dad's success, or the way that he achieved it, was he just spoke the simple truth, and it was shocking, you know? So anyway, but I guess I'm trying to spin it positively because I've been extremely hard on Rand in the past. But it seemed like, hey, maybe he was listening finally and thinking, Jesus, my last chance. I got to start finally reading my dad's articles and talking like that. And, you know, maybe it's a start, Daniel.
I hope so. And I look forward to hearing more of that from him in the next debate next month. Yep.
All right, y'all. Well, that is the great Daniel Larrison. Thanks so much for all your work. I really appreciate it, Daniel.
Thanks, Scott.
All right, y'all. That's Daniel Larrison. Check him out at theamericanconservative.com/Larrison for his great blog. And we'll be back in just one sec to talk with Dan Sanchez about Star Wars.
I love Bitcoin, but there's just something incredibly satisfying about having real, fine silver in your pocket. That's why commodity discs are so neat. They're 1 ounce rounds of fine silver with a QR code on the back. Just grab your smartphone's QR reader, scan the coin, and you'll instantly get the silver spot price in Federal Reserve notes and Bitcoin. And if you donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, he'll send you one. Learn more at facebook.com/commodity discs. Commoditydiscs.com.
Hey, all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show.
This idea of a democracy being given up, and in many cases being given up in a time of crisis, you see it throughout history, whether it's Julius Caesar or Napoleon or Adolf Hitler. You see these democracies under a lot of pressure, in a crisis situation, who end up giving up a lot of the freedoms they have and a lot of the checks and balances to somebody with a strong authority to help get them through the crisis. You know, it's not the first time a politician has created a war to try to stay in office.
To counter the increasing threats of the separatists.
It is done, then.
Yep. All right. So, I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, yeah, I am a worse Star Wars geek than you. I don't dress up in costumes and all that, but my entire childhood was consumed by Star Wars. I'm very happy about that, by the way. On the line, I've got my friend Dan Sanchez, your friend, too. He's at the Mises Institute and antiwar.com, and also anti-media. You can find his articles there. And he's got a couple here recent about Star Wars. First, the neocon hunger for universal empire. And then secondly, the road to galactic serfdom, war, tyranny, and terror in the first two Star Wars trilogies. You can find that one right there in the right margin at antiwar.com. Welcome back to the show. How you doing, Dan?
Great, thanks.
Good, good. So you like Star Wars too, huh?
Yeah. I wasn't a big fan earlier, but I was interested in catching up with a new one coming out, and And I think I wasn't really politically aware the first time I saw it, so I was able to tease out a lot more this last time around.
Oh, that's cool. So you just went back, even very recently, watched all through the prequels and all that. See, that's funny because I grew up on all this stuff, and you think a lot more great stuff about it than me that you wrote here. Maybe that's why I'm still a little kid on the issue. But yeah, no, I love it. This is how I learned to prefer a republic to an empire in the first place, which I think was the point, as Lucas was saying there, and this is part of the story, was that after Nixon's landslide in 72, there was some talk, this is before the Watergate thing got too bad, there was some talk about maybe we need to repeal the 22nd Amendment because of the emergency, and so that Nixon can stay in office like Franklin Roosevelt did in order to protect us all. And that was what gave Lucas the idea in the first place, that he wanted to do a movie to kind of inoculate people against that kind of thinking that, as Han Solo says, there's no time to discuss this in committee. And if there's not, you're going to lose all your freedom. You're going to have to figure out something.
Yeah, that's really the key. That's what I think the prequels especially are a great analogy for. Because it's all about the rise of the Sith, and the distinctive way in which the Sith rises is through generating war and crisis, and using those wars and crises to justify expanded powers, especially for Palpatine, who later becomes the Emperor. So I really thought it was a great illustration of some important thinkers. Specifically three of them, Randolph Bourne, Robert Higgs, and F.A. Hayek. Now, Bourne talks about how war is the health of the state, and especially because people start to clamor for greater powers for the central state in order to feel secure, and that's exactly what you have with all these wars, is that Palpatine is given these emergency powers that he promises solemnly that he will relinquish once the crisis has passed, but of course he doesn't. And as it turns out, that again, he was the one who instigated these wars, and that has a great analogy in terms of history, because the state is aware that war is the health of the state, and that's why states love war so much. And so you see throughout history states dragging their populace into these wars in order to shore up and expand their own power, and it's worked every time. That and it's a part of a more general phenomenon that Robert Higgs talks about, especially in his book Crisis and Leviathan, where crisis in general, including wars, are often used for the sake of expanding power. And Higgs also talks about something he calls the ratchet effect, where even though after the war or crisis has passed, the emergency powers will be brought down, they never go down all the way to the pre-crisis level. So with every passing crisis and every passing war, the power and size of the state keeps ratcheting up. And then finally, F.A. Hayek, there's a great scene where Anakin and Padme are talking about Anakin's ideal governmental system. And Anakin says, we need a system where the politicians sit down and discuss the problems, agree what's in the best interest of all the people, and then do it. Padme says, that's exactly what we do. The trouble is that people don't always agree. In fact, they hardly do. Anakin says, then they should be made to. Padme says, by whom? Who's going to make them? He says, someone wise. She says, that sounds an awful lot like dictatorship to me. And he says, well, if it works. And of course, this is before he turns to Darth Vader. And this is basically what Hayek talks about when in The Road to Serfdom, when he says that that especially this kind of what he calls an impatience with the impotence of democracy, that it's a function of democracies being given too broad of a mandate to accomplish society's ends through planning. So he says that agreement that planning is necessary, together with the inability of democratic assemblies to produce a plan, will evoke stronger and stronger demands that the government or some single individual should be given powers to act on their own responsibility. The belief is becoming more and more widespread that if things are to get done, the responsible authorities must be freed from the fetters of democratic procedure. And later on, that he talks about how that explains the rise of Hitler, because Weimar Germany had embraced planning. And so he says that it's important to remember that for some time before 1933, Germany had reached a stage in which it had, in effect, had to be governed dictatorially. Nobody could then doubt that for the time being, democracy had broken down. Hitler did not have to destroy democracy. He merely took advantage of the decay of democracy and at the critical moment obtained the support of many to whom, though they detested Hitler, he yet seemed the only man strong enough to get things done. So again, that's the phenomenon of a strong man cutting the Gordian knot of the parliamentary discord. And it's very worrying because you see that today, that that's part of the appeal of Trump, that people see him as a strong man. And but really all the candidates are potential strong men who people might want to empower in order to establish the plan that they desperately want but are so frustrated that the democratic procedures aren't able to come to a consensus on.
Right. Yeah, and then, you know, what's funny is even after all this time, the absolute myth holds that, well, Mussolini did make the trains run on time. And that's kind of actually one of the mistaken messages of all the fascism in Star Wars, I think, is that, hey, listen, if you have a Vader or a Palpatine who will threaten death for anyone who fails them, they are very efficient at making and deploying Star Destroyers and, you know, using them effectively and whatever. That's one lesson that should have been in Star Wars, is that, all the time I spent in government employment, I don't know if any of this is going to work out, you know? Seems like,
yeah.
My TIE fighter keeps short-circuiting and this kind of crap. Got shocked in the bathroom. We'll be right back with Dan Sanchez in just 1 second, y'all.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts.
Hey guys, welcome back. Happy Star Wars Day. Episode 7 finally comes out today. I'm going to go see it. Hope everybody's got their tickets in order. Talking on the line with Dan Sanchez from Mises and Antiwar.com. The Road to Galactic Serfdom. And I always thought it was funny that especially right-wingers always thought, or maybe now they finally get it or something in a way, but they always thought that Star Wars was somehow about the Soviet Union. Really? It was the Soviet Union, a republic that became an empire? I don't remember that. I'm pretty sure that George Lucas is from here. And obviously the lesson is for us and about us. And, you know, as he said in that clip I played at the top of the show, how people willingly give away their liberty to people who frighten them or in circumstances where they're frightened anyway. And so you make some really great points in this article, Dan. I really hope everyone will go read it. The Road to Galactic Serfdom. It's at antiwar.com. And I like the way you put it in terms of the libertarian heroes, too, to really get people interested here. Randolph Bourne, War is the Health of the State. Robert Higgs, Every Crisis, Especially War. leads to this ratchet effect where their power increases more and more, and even when the crisis is over, it never quite goes back to the way it was before, even if it kind of subsides some. But then the point that I really wanted to pick up on right here was the point about Hayek, and or another one you could quote, Hayek, The Road to Serfdom, obviously, like in the title. But Mises, too, said the middle of the road leads to socialism, by which I think he basically meant, you know, communism and government ownership of everything or whatever, because the point being that every government intervention only distorts something and makes it worse, only drives up a price, drives down a quality of service, and gives and creates more and more problems and more reasons for people to ask for more and more government to solve their problems. And then, as you put it in here on the road to serfdom model, things become such a mess that people, they just won't listen to Ron Paul tell them, all we got to do is repeal everything and freedom will take care of everything. They rather listen to a Trump say, give the power to me and I'll whip that bureaucracy into shape. I'm powerful enough that I can make the engine move the way you want it to move. And they believe that. And then, of course, boy, what comes after him, right? Holy crap.
Yeah, and Mises's middle of the road path to socialism is sort of a cyclical path, too. And it really dovetails with what Yoda says when he says, if once you start down the dark path, forever will it dominate your destiny, consume you, it will. And the reason why, in Mises' formulation, is that these interventions, in order to solve a problem, just makes the problems worse and creates greater problems. And then that, in turn, leads to calls for even further intervention, which just creates more problems and more state control over the economy. And you just keep going down that path, and eventually it leads to complete economic planning, to socialism. And you see the same thing with war. And that leads to another Yoda quote where he talks about fear being the path to the dark side. He says that fear leads to anger, anger leads to hate, hate leads to suffering. And the thing is that loops around, because suffering then leads to anger. And so it becomes a cycle. And that is a perfect analogy, I think, for the wars and the terrorism that we've been afflicted with. So that fear leading to anger, I mean, you see that with, just as an arbitrary, kind of an arbitrary starting point, because it has begun ever since the beginning of the warfare state. But with 9/11, which itself was blowback, leading to terror, that not only were people struck by terrorists, but they allowed themselves to be stricken with terror to such an extent that, and I think there's a useful distinction between fear and terror, that terror is what leads you to hate. I mean, fear is a useful emotion, but terror is where it becomes irrational and where it becomes to such an extent that you justify doing evil yourself. And so you see that throughout the Star Wars trilogies, that especially with the prequels, that's Anakin's path to the dark side, that Yoda predicted when he first met Anakin, because Anakin is terrified of losing his mother, and Yoda sees that from the beginning, and that does actually lead to his fall into the dark side, because terror does lead to hate, because when his mother does die, then he becomes so angry that he admits to killing children and the women and children of the Tusken Raiders who had killed her. And that's a very good analogy of what America was willing to embrace. Like Dick Cheney said that we need to embrace the dark side. And America was willing to embrace the dark side in the form of, you know, a million civilian deaths in Iraq, and now 4 million Muslim deaths in the terror wars in general. And that only leads to suffering, because that leads to more blowback in the form of terrorism, in the form of the refugee crisis, in the form of the burgeoning police state. And then that terror then completes the loop and then leads to more anger and hate and more suffering.
And now, so here's the thing too, is you're really explaining how great the prequels could have been, the same story in the hands of a better screenwriter and a better director, because there's so much there to love about the manipulation of the Sith and the parallels between, the crises created by Palpatine in the movie, along with the history of America's wars that are all in there as well. The Civil War is well represented in episodes 2 and 3, the Terror War in episode 3, especially. And the thing is, they were successful at getting some of those messages through at the time they came out back a decade ago, but they haven't stood the test of time, unfortunately, I think, in the minds of most, and I guess I'd have to include myself, but what the hell, I love it anyway, because I have to, because
yeah, and
who I am.
See, George, I agree that George Lucas was good on the broad ideas and the broad themes. He just needed help to execute it well. Another one of the, what was really applicable to the times when it came out was when Anakin says, if you're not with me, you're the enemy. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that was obviously a direct echo of George Bush when he said, if you're not with us, you're with the terrorists. And the interesting thing is that Osama bin Laden explicitly endorsed Bush's statement to that effect, mm-hmm. that he liked that framework for the conflict. Because he wanted everyone to either be with what he called the Crusaders or be with the terrorists. And now ISIS, with their deliberate strategy in their official magazine, they call that eliminating the gray zone. They want a black and white struggle between the Crusaders and the terrorists, what the neocons call a clash of civilizations. And so that's why they commit these terror attacks to, one of the main reasons is in order to both to polarize people into the Crusader camp and, to have the response of the Western governments be so brutal to Muslims that it drives them into the extremist camp, the extreme Islamist camp as well. And it's very apocalyptic that the terrorists are similar to the neocons in that they want this clash of civilization. They want this apocalyptic showdown because each side thinks that it'll end up coming out victorious. So really, they're kind of allies. They're both allies with the people who want peace, who want coexistence, both the extremists of the empire and the extremists of the terrorists.
Mm. Yeah, the analogy breaks down when it comes to, you know, the original series, and it's funny to listen to the neocons take the side of the Empire. I don't think anybody on our side said or would say that the terrorists make a very good, metaphor, or that, you know, or the Rebel Alliance of Luke and Leia make a good metaphor for the terrorists. It seems more like the parallel for them is the droid army, the big fake threat that's engineered by the Republic itself in order to become an empire. And so just because the U.S. is the bad guys doesn't mean that Osama is Luke Skywalker or anything like that. But then what the neocons do is they go, oh yeah, look, see, Luke Skywalker is ISIS. Luke Skywalker and the Rebel Alliance, why they're a bunch of terrorists trying to tear down all the Sith's hard work when all they're trying to do is create a little bit of peace and stability around here, Dan.
Yeah, I call these the endless clickbait articles to this effect, the neo-contrarians, because they feel so smug and clever that, oh, the Empire is actually the good guys and Luke is actually the bad guy. But one of the things that I stress in the article is how Luke really resisted the dark side, of course, but that exact shows how he's exactly the opposite from a terrorist, because that's what terrorists do, is that they yield to their hate to the point where they're willing to commit aggression, because that's another component that Yoda in the original trilogy says is part of the dark side, is he uses the word aggression. And so that I think that's an important parallel you can draw with the libertarian theory of the non-aggression principle, that there's violence, but then there's the initiation of violence, which is aggression. And violence in self-defense, like Yoda says, is fine, and like libertarians say. But it's when you initiate violence against what you call collateral damage, against innocent civilians, that's the dark side. And that's exactly what Luke resisted, because and that's why he triumphed where his father had failed, that his father yielded to aggression, that he killed the baby Tusken Raiders, and he executed surrendered prisoners, and that led him to the dark side. But whereas Luke, that he resisted it when the Emperor was trying to goad him into executing his own father when he was disabled, when he was basically defeated, that he resisted and he said, "I'm not going to yield to the dark side." And that, in a sense, sort of, then his father later says that you already saved me, because he says, "I want to save you," and he says, "You already have," and because in a sense that he redeemed him, that he inspired his own father to also turn against the dark side at the very end, finally, by his example of resisting terror, of renouncing hate, of abstaining from aggression, of not yielding to the dark side.
Mm-hmm. It's very libertarian for a movie that's originally made up by a guy who, as far as I can tell, is some kind of Bill Clinton liberal Democrat or something, but that's all you got to do. It's the whole point of the whole damn story. You just drop the article. It's not about the force. It's about force. The light side and the dark side of force. It doesn't preach pacifism, but it says, you know, for knowledge and defense, never for attack. Simple as that.
Right. And going to back to what you were saying about the defending the empire, it really is amazing because, like you say, it was thought of as like a Soviet thing. And even just the language, that Reagan adopting the term the evil empire for the Soviets. I mean, that was obviously taking from the earlier Star Wars movie, and calling the Afghan Mujahideen, the precursors to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, how Reagan called them the freedom fighters, because that was in the opening scroll of one of the original Star Wars trilogy movies too, was calling the rebels freedom fighters, and just really, you know, co-opting that language. And then later on, you have the same neocons defending the empire as this empire that was seemingly representing the hated Soviets, taking that as a good model for America itself, that you have Jonathan Last in 2002 had a defense of the empire, saying that, oh, you know, it's this, you know, great force for order and for security, and even to the extent of justifying the destruction of a whole planet with a Death Star, and justifying gunning down Luke's parents because, you know, the planet was a front for rebel activity, and Leia was lying because lying about the planet not having weapons. I mean, it's identical to, at the same exact time, this was in 2002 that this article was written, when they were saying that Saddam is lying about Iraq having weapons. And so in the same way that
Afghanistan is too remote to make an effective demonstration, but don't worry, we'll deal with them soon enough.
Right, right. And so yeah, and they just keep on with that, because very recently, then Continetti, another William Crystal protege, penned a defense of the empire, and they basically with the Iraq war, that they justified, well, you know, there might be terrorists in Iraq, and so they justified massacring civilians there, in the same way that, you know, they say that Luke's parents might have been harboring, you know, terrorist droids in Tatooine. And even how Tatooine is like an arid landscape. It was actually filmed on location in Tunisia. I mean, they think that these examples you know, play into their argument when they play to the exact opposite of their argument. It just goes to show, you know, how much the Star Wars films are an analogy for just the failure of their policy. And
yeah, it is great that they don't, they're perfectly happy to say, yes, of course, the Emperor and Darth Vader are the good guys. They're trying to centralize all authority and put everybody under their wise boot heel. Everybody knows that's what to do. And they really think that. And I guess there is a small segment of the population that'll go for that. But yeah, no, I mean, and that's always been the good thing about the neocons is they have no sense of their own absurdity whatsoever. So
yeah,
they'll go ahead and tell you exactly what they're about, all right?
Especially William Crystal, who is just comically known for being wrong about everything. And yet he's the one who keeps tweeting these defenses for the Empire. And he's the one who thinks that the Empire is a model for what he called benevolent global hegemony in that famous article from the 90s that he wrote, that that it's just a model for that. And it's just so tone deaf because everybody knows the Empire is evil. So if you keep trying to defend them, but it just keeps reinforcing the association, the correct association that people have between the neocons and the Empire, which they know is evil.
Yep. Yeah, that's funny. You know, I had a friend who didn't like Star Wars because he said, look, unless your president is shooting lightning out of his hands, then people can't see it for what it really is, because Star Wars has just, you know, basically raised the bar of what counts as empire or not to such a cartoonish degree or whatever. But he wasn't counting on Bill Crystal, and they will outright identify with the guy shooting the lightning out of his hands, the evil wizard from the movie. That's their guy, all right. No problem whatsoever, so we can rest assured. And now, so, no spoilers, because I don't know anything about it, and neither do you, but there's a lot of red, white, and black in the trailers, and looks like a lot of Nazi themes and this and that, and so what are your hopes for the new one? If you have time, I'm keeping you way over time here, but are you going to see the movie tonight? What do you think?
I think I'm going to see it on maybe Sunday or next week sometime. But I mean, just from the trailers, there's the scene of the main characters jumping away from a tent in the desert when an airstrike happens, and I think that is, you know, potentially, you know, an interesting analogy with all the drone strikes making the rubble bounce in all these. Mm-hmm. Desert atmospheres with launching these multi-million dollar missiles at these $5 tents throughout
right.
the world, and how just horribly imperialistic and obviously evil that is.
Yeah, that really is right there. First and foremost in the trailer is showing all these stormtroopers with flamethrowers and all their rifles in a full scale assault against a bunch of lean-tos. What?
Right. And that's another analogy, is that a great analogy from the prequels is the fact that the stormtroopers were clones, and they were bred for docility, that they were bred, bioengineered to follow orders, basically. And that again plays into, Bourne's, this notion that war is the health of the state, because that's the kind of docility that war breeds among people, because people get so frightened for their security that they become like sheep to the government shepherds, willing to just be regimented the way that stormtroopers are and follow orders. And then having that standing army is what really backed Palpatine's rise to become emperor.
Yeah, that is a good one. Hey, listen, I'm sure you got to go, and I do too, and I kept you way over time here. But thanks for writing this really great article. Everybody, please go read it. Actually, there's a couple of them. They're both at antiwar.com, I'm pretty sure, right?
Yes.
They are. And the other one is also at your own site. I had it here somewhere here. Yeah, The Neocon Hunger for Universal Empire and The Road to Galactic Serfdom by Dan Sanchez, both at antiwar.com.
Thanks, Scott. It was great.
Thanks very much, dude. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, great to talk to you. Bye.